You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, December 8th, 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live, steps, from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Emily Flitter, reporter covering banking and Wall Street for the New York Times and author of The White Wall, How Big Finance Bankrupts Black America. Meanwhile, after 10 months of imprisonment, WNBA star Brittany Griner is finally free. The White House made a deal for a prisoner swap for convicted Russian arms dealer Viktor Boot. The House just passed the bill protecting same-sex marriage that had passed the Senate already. It also protects interracial marriage. It passed 258 to 169. It heads to Biden's desk for a signature now. It's a huge help to protect against Supreme Court malfeasance in that area. Speaking of the extremist Supreme Court, they heard oral arguments yesterday in a case that would give state legislatures control over federal elections. It is as crazy as it sounds. Kavanaugh, Coney Barrett, and Roberts appear to be trying to find a compromise position for this insanity. The Biden administration is appealing a ruling that limited its authority to use Title 42. Although the order is still on track to end in a few weeks, they just want, you know, this draconian program in their back pocket. Pentagon officials are reportedly furious over Congress likely striking a deal that would end the military's COVID vaccine mandate, citing logistical and health nightmares. Makes sense. Gas prices have precipitously fallen. They're now lower than they were a year ago today, on average. That's good news on the inflation front, but the Fed's disciplining of labor in order to tamp down inflation is beginning to make its effects felt. Jobless claims ticked up last week. 1,100 unionized New York Times staffers are striking today for badly needed pay increases at a time when the paper's profits are rapidly increasing. Solidarity with the New York Times Guild. In Peru, left-leaning President Pedro Castillo has been ousted and arrested after trying to dissolve Congress, who was trying to impeach him on corruption charges for the third time. And lastly, in Iran, authorities have announced that they have executed a protester who was arrested in the latest uprisings. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome to the show, everybody. It's an Majority Report Thursday. Good day to you all. Good news this morning, hearing Brittany Griner, kind of first thing when I woke up, I saw that. It took way too long, but I'm just happy it's happening.
Yeah.
You read just about some of what she was going through and, like, you know, her lawyer speaking about her emotional state being at a low point, which makes total sense. She
gets up to a, you know, penal colony to work.
Yeah, and yeah. She's 6'9", like, they had to build a special bed for her. She had 1 hour outside a day, and it was all for cannabis cartridges, and so Russia could have a leg up in, like, a political standoff with the United States. So it's a good thing that she's coming back. Let's lead with that to start the show here, because here is President Biden announcing this morning that he's spoken with Brittany Griner on the phone, and he does confirm here to the press that they are freeing her in exchange for a Russian prisoner, Viktor Boot. And we'll get more into him in a second, but here's Biden's announcement.
Good morning, folks, and it is a good morning. Moments ago, standing together with her wife, Sherelle, in the Oval Office, I spoke with Brittany Griner. She's safe. She's on a plane. She's on her way home. After months of being unjustly detained in Russia, held under intolerable circumstances, Brittany will soon be back in the arms of her loved ones, and she should have been there all along. This is a day we've worked toward for a long time. We never stopped pushing for her release. It took painstaking and intense negotiations, and I want to thank all the hardworking public servants across my administration who worked tirelessly to secure her release.
Now, to me, this is just obvious good news. An American detained unjustly overseas for cannabis. I mean, the fact is that here in the United States, we do that, by the way.
This is what the drug war is for. Like, it is, it's harder to believe, I guess, in situations like this when it's a notable individual, but these laws were instituted to control certain populations and allow the state to sort of intervene in them. And it's not always obviously for, make them prisoners to captive for sort of leverage in, you know, geopolitical conflicts. In places like America, it's cops say, hey, we busted you for drugs. You can either become an informant for us or we can warehouse you in a prison for, you know, 30 years or whatever. Right. And until we that's what's always been super frustrating about this is we continue to do this similar sort of thing here. And we're actually one of the pioneers in doing this sort of drug mm-hmm. war and one of the main sort of like people backing it up on the world stage. So it's really I agree with you that I think it's 100% great that Griner's coming back, and then we need to undo this stuff in America because this is on a grand scale what we've been doing on the mass scale.
There are people still in prison who are, and we've made great gains on that front. But at the same time, it's like the hypocrisy about our stances on some of this stuff doesn't really end there, because some of the right wing reactions to Viktor Boot being released also highlights, frankly, like a lack of collective knowledge of what we do to human beings and what our intelligence agencies do in mass and systemically around the world, because there's a lot of hand-wringing right now about, oh, he's been called the merchant of death and we're releasing this dangerous man back into Russia, because I guess now, Russia, or not so good news, Russia's going to have access to guns now. They didn't have them before, yeah. But now that the arms dealer is returning, Thanos is coming back. I guess the big bad is going to allow them to engage in warfare. I'm being facetious because it's just like the people are saying that Biden is releasing this violent man, and by all accounts, he is that a violent man. But we have no leg to stand on when it comes to selling arms to bad actors, to terrorist organizations, to guerrilla fighters that fit our agenda, to both sides of conflicts, which is what he's also being accused of. He has, or was accused of and convicted of, he was convicted of something, I think, separate. But, like, he sold weapons to Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and other groups as well. What the United States got him on was they posed, DEA agents posed undercover as rebels for the Colombian Revolutionary Armed Forces, which is like a left-wing guerrilla group there. And then they were able to imprison him and stuff. So, you know, point being for me is this is a slam dunk deal. The hypocrisy outside of it. It's just there's no cost to doing this.
Yeah, I mean, it's a cost that I don't particularly
care about.
Care about.
Yeah, I don't think anybody should care about it. It's just,
like, to the extent we care that there are arms dealers in the world, I think it doesn't start with this individual. Like, it's a broader, it's going to take a broader initiative that I don't really see on the horizon towards getting guns out of the world.
Right. So, good that Brittany Griner is coming home, and it took way too long, but happy that it did happen.
And that should also factor into, like, say, WNBA revenue sharing conversations, so that maybe star athletes don't need to go play during the summer off months in Russia, for instance, to make some more money.
There you go. Good. Right. Exactly. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Emily Flitter. We are back, and we are joined now by Emily Flitter, reporter covering banking and Wall Street for the New York Times and author of the book, The White Wall, How Big Finance Bankrupts Black America. Emily, thanks so much for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. So let's just start a little bit of an aside, but it's so important to mention here. Over 1,000 unionized New York Times workers are striking right now. It's quite historic what's happening here. And it's at a time where the paper has been making a lot of money. There's been a big acquisition with The Athletic, and there's a lot of money coming in. And the pay for workers at the New York Times has not reflected that increase. So if you don't mind just speaking to that and what's happening at your paper right now.
We are doing a one-day walkout. We have 1,000 guild members participating in this action. It's really the first time it's happened like this in decades, where we've all stopped work for a full day. We're trying to make the management understand how important it is to treat their employees right. It's not just for the highest paid journalists, but all the way down to our security guards and the people who support the work that we do every day. It's really important that we have pay raises that are reflective of the environment that we're living in. The prices in New York City have never been higher, and we deserve fair pay. We deserve fair and affordable health care. And the company really hasn't budged on those important issues. So we would hope that this shows them that we're serious and that they need to listen to us and reach a deal with us that actually treats us fairly.
Yeah, I mean, 100%. And there's some action happening today as well, I believe. If you're in the New York area and you want to show support, do what you can, support the New York Times Guild. I think there's like a rally at 1 p.m., if you don't mind just plugging that really quickly.
Correct. Outside the New York Times building, there's a rally. Perhaps you will get to see the big inflatable rat. So come on down. It's a Times Square attraction.
Yeah, exactly. It certainly is. It catches my eye for sure. I mean, it's meant to.
It's been in Brooklyn by Long Island University in the past few months too. So.
Oh, there you go. Well, right. If you want a rat sighting, I mean, you could go the subway, or you can go go see it at 1 p.m. outside the New York Times building. So anyway, let's now dive into your book, if you don't mind. Your book's entitled, as I mentioned earlier, The White Wall, How Big Finance Bankrupts Black America. Let's start big picture. Can you just give us a sense of the sheer size of the racial wealth gap in this country right now, which is in many ways foundational to what you write about in your book?
Well, it's enormous. Black households have less than 15% of the wealth that white households have. And it's a gap that has existed since this country was founded and slaves were freed, and it lasted all the way through the civil rights movement. I mean, obviously it was worse during slavery, you know, slaves weren't paid at all, but ever since we had a measurable household wealth, number in our modern age, this gap has been there and it hasn't gotten any better.
Yeah, it certainly has not. I mean, one of the statistics I'm totally blanking on it, but you did cite how, like, basically since 1968, that gap has not changed between white and black families, and like big economic shocks like the 2008 crash disproportionately hurt black families in particular.
That's correct. It's really important to note that the gap hasn't changed since 1968 because it speaks to a problem that we have, which is at the heart of what I'm writing about in this book, which is that there's a racial progress narrative in this country. And that's where, you know, you go to school and somebody like explains what happened with slavery on a first grade level. And the ending of the story is almost like a fairy tale ending. The slaves were freed. And then we had Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And then he made sure that everyone was going to be treated equally. And now everything is fixed. Guess what? It's not.
Yeah. I mean, I find that fairy tale proclivity to be like infuriating. I mean, I always talk about this, but how Ronald Reagan is the one that put that created Martin Luther King Day, or, you know, enshrined it and made it a federal holiday. And it's like, you know, that contributes to that dynamic, which is it makes it almost like a fairy tale, as you say, you know, essentially saying this is over here. Here's our hero of the civil rights movement and we can commemorate it and move on, especially when it was Reagan who implemented it. But yeah, go on.
Well, I would also just point out that this isn't something that's limited to what happens to first graders. This is something that we actually heard from the Supreme Court recently in the affirmative action case that the Supreme Court heard this fall. I believe it was Justice Alito, and I don't have that information in front of me, so let's all double check that, who said the Civil War was fought to end discrimination. That is not what the Civil War was fought for, and that's not what the outcome of the war was.
Yeah, certainly not. There's a lot of revisionism there. And you spoke about like the legacy of slavery there, and something that you wrote about that I found was really interesting was Citi, one of the big banks that you highlight in your book. I was unfamiliar with some of its history with slavery in particular as being foundational to the bank and its construction. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well, you're not alone in being unfamiliar with that. Everyone pretty much was, because Citi has not publicly talked about it. But Citi's predecessor, Citibank of New York, was a bank founded in 1812 that was grown, bolstered, and protected by one man who you could call the grandfather of Citi. His name was Moses Taylor, and he made a fortune as a sugar trader. So he would go to Cuba, build up all of these relationships with sugar producers, and import the sugar to the United States. In fact, his trading house at one point represented a large fraction of all of the sugar that was being imported into the country. Without the number in front of me, I can't remember whether it was a fifth or a third. Either way, that's a lot for one man. And Moses Taylor was buying sugar from from slave plantations. That was how the sugar was being produced in Cuba. So his wealth and riches came from the from an industry that was fueled entirely by slave labor. In addition, Taylor had an economic relationship with these plantation owners that went beyond just buying their sugar. He got equipment from them from Europe, and there are certainly there's a possibility that he even helped transport slaves from the old world to the new world for the Cuban sugar traders. Although we don't have specific records of that, he was doing this kind of trading with the Cuban sugar traders at a time when slavery was outlawed, and anyone bringing slaves over would have had to hide them. So that's important for City because in the period where Moses Taylor became involved in the bank, the banking system in the United States was really fragile and there were these panics. And Taylor's involvement in City helped protect City from succumbing to those panics. He eventually became president of the bank. It's not clear whether he used his personal wealth to support the bank, but historians have described City at various times as being his personal bank. And there being a very small separation between his outside business and the bank. And City has not acknowledged that publicly, that so much of the power and the wealth that kept the bank going through the hard times in the first half of the 19th century came from this source.
Is that unique to banks that have a long history? Because my guess is, well, one, what's notable, as you mentioned, is the fact that you basically have uncovered this and it was not publicly available knowledge really before your reporting on it. But for banks that have been in existence for a long period of time in this country, it's probably virtually impossible, just given the fact that, like, because of capitalism and because slavery was so foundational to the United States economy, that there are not roots in slavery for all of these banks, right?
Well, actually, there was a push to get banks and other businesses to explore and expose their roots. City was included in this. This was an early 2000s era push that was made by Chicago, the state of California, the city of Milwaukee, which adopted these laws called slavery era disclosure ordinances that basically said, if you want to do business with us as a municipality, if you're, you know, a business, you want a contract, you have to first research your ties to slavery and disclose them to us. All the banks, the major banks that wanted to do business with the city of Chicago did that, and City did it too. But each bank decided to define who its predecessors were. And also they had to define what it meant to profit from slavery. That's partly why City was able to declare, or felt at the time that it was able to declare, that they had not profited from slavery, because City hadn't written any mortgages on slaves or done anything that was just indisputably business done by the bank directly touching slaves. There were other banks. Bank of America, for instance, initially said it had not profited from slavery, but there were other people who, you know, were outside of this commercial historical effort who did their own research and said, hey, Bank of America, you missed some stuff. And that was, for instance, one of the Bank of America's predecessor banks was actually founded by a really prominent slave trader. And that bank became the bank of the Port of Providence. And so everything that went through the Port of Providence that came in on a ship was levied. There was a customs duty levied at the port, and slaves came through there. People came through there, and the proceeds from the customs duties went into this bank. And yet Bank of America chose to say initially that doesn't count. In fact, they've still not admitted that part of it, but they did go back and say, okay, we found some things. So the banks have had to do this, but it just never got the attention and the fulsome acknowledgement that it really deserved.
And part of that is, as you say, is because they were responsible essentially for reporting on themselves to a degree for that effort that you describe.
Correct.
Yeah. So, I mean, that does create some perverse incentives, for sure. I want to move to some of the other things that you explored, which included, you have a lot of like jarring large scale statistics that you provide, but also you found documentation about some small interactions. Even just when you go down to like the bank teller, making a judgment call on what check can get cashed and what checks don't get cashed. Can you talk a bit about that?
Sure. So this happens in the news frequently. It's kind of a steady stream of stories that are coming out where a black customer goes to a bank, wants to cash a check, wants to make a withdrawal, and all of a sudden things go south. The tellers don't believe that that person has the money or has been given a check with that value. So they call the cops or they send the person away. I write about instances where this occurred at Wells Fargo. It kind of doesn't matter what the bank is, but because they all have this problem where the tellers immediately racially profile people who walk in the door. But I was able to see emails.
Oh, I'm sorry. We lost your audio.
Are you how about now?
Sorry about that, guys. Think we got that fixed. Emily, if you don't mind, just maybe backing up a second and then continuing because you cut off briefly.
Sure. I was talking about these emails that I got that show JP Morgan Chase tellers assessing customers who walk in the door and warning each other about customers they think are suspicious. In itself, this is not a strange thing to do because there are people out there who try to scam banks with all kinds of different methods. For instance, I saw an email where one teller was warning a network of tellers at nearby branches that somebody had tried to use a card, a bank card, to make a withdrawal that was already reported stolen. And the IDs didn't match, and it was just really clear that it wasn't the bank customer. But then I saw emails that didn't really describe anything bad. They just described black customers. I saw an email, which is in the book, in which a young man with blonde dreadlocks comes in with a check that he wants to cash, and the teller doesn't believe that he is the rightful recipient of the check. I'm not sure if I just mentioned this, but he's black. He has blonde dreads, and that's all they use to describe him. He gets agitated when they won't cash the check, and the teller actually calls the issuer of the check, who confirms that the check was meant for this guy. But instead, the customer has gone. He's taken his check with him. The teller's message isn't, "I made a mistake and please cash this guy's check if he comes to your branch." It's just a description of this guy under the subject line, "Please use caution." I saw several of these emails that described black customers trying to do normal business. I didn't see emails describing white customers using their race. So it really seemed like the black customers' race, their skin color, was standing out to these tellers and creating an automatic mark of suspicion.
I mean, part of that is like a function of just like existing in our racist society, but what you do point out is like, just, I mean, based on systemic issues with banking. The fish doesn't rot from the head down to a degree. And I think that that's a lot of what your documentation reflected there. Just some other things, because I know we don't have you for too much longer. You also write about how, in order to root out some of these biases, financial institutions will talk about, like, oh, we're going to move to an algorithm, right? And we see this in the context of tech, that the algorithm for, say, a social media site will favor reactionary content because that gets more clicks, and, like, it has the perception of, oh, we're just using an algorithm, so it's completely scientific and it can't have any human biases embedded in it. And for banking, it's kind of the same dynamic, right? They're using that, but it doesn't actually fix the problem.
That's right. There are a lot of financial companies out there that use algorithms. It isn't just banks. It's non-bank lenders. Insurers use them to flag fraud. All of these companies that rely on computer programs are presenting that reliance as a way to sort of clean up their acts. Like, we are taking the human biases out of this. But the entire industry that creates these programs and the banks' abilities to vet them everything is suspect. You don't know what data is going in. You don't know what the people who are manipulating the data and writing the programs are thinking. And the banks aren't showing us any of this. Neither are any of the other financial firms who use these algorithms. What I found, though, was that when there is a problem, I focused on US Bank and the head of AI who was hired there to expand their use of this technology. Well, she looked at what they had for AI and said, this is problematic. I found that these programs don't work the way they should. US Bank didn't really address her problems and she left the bank. So if that's what happens in a situation where somebody raises their hand and says, hey, I found a problem, what about all of the other times that somebody doesn't even bother to raise their hands? Mm-hmm. How are we supposed to know that somebody's really watching over these programs, keeping track of what they do over time and keeping track of the data that goes into them and whether that data is biased?
Yeah, I mean, if Sam were here, it would be a big opportunity for him to push for postal banking. And I mean, that is something we've talked about at length on this program, might alleviate some of this. This question is a bit more like news related, but I do think that a lot of what you discuss in your book ties into it. I was hoping you could give me your take on how crypto plays into this, because there's a lot of unbanked people, regular people were trying to get into that. It was presented as this democratizing force where you too could purchase your way into these financial systems and make a lot of money in the way that Wall Street tycoons do. And of course, we've seen that a lot of people have lost a lot of money by having faith in that system. And big banks, they didn't always advertise it front facingly, but they dipped their toe into crypto as well. What did you find with cryptocurrency related to these institutions?
I'm so glad you asked this question. I just wrote a story about what FTX was doing to make itself look good in Washington. FTX, of course, is the collapsed cryptocurrency exchange founded and run by Sam Bankman-Fried. And I found that FTX was actually blasting out these emails bragging about supporting an organization in Chicago called Equity in Transition that was providing guaranteed income to families of recently incarcerated people who then got out of jail. And FTX representatives actually reached out to Equity in Transition and said, we want to fund a part of this guaranteed income program. And the founder of the organization in Chicago, Richard Wallace, said, well, great. You know, we only had so much money to give guaranteed income to so many people. We're just going to expand it. This will be great. We can use the data to prove that guaranteed income works. FTX then used that as an example in its communications with lawmakers and policymakers and people in think tanks to say, look how great we are. Look how crypto is helping equalize the financial landscape. Well, I talked to Richard Wallace, the founder of Equity in Transition. I said, were these recipients of guaranteed income getting crypto? He said, are you kidding me? These people just got out of jail and their families. And the last thing we were going to do is give them something that fluctuated in value and had all these transaction fees and tech requirements just to get to it. He said, we said, we're not doing this program unless you provide the funds in cash. FTX agreed to do that. And then they collapsed and they had been bragging about doing it for months and they never actually gave this organization the money. I think that's a great illustration of the hype around crypto and the reality. Crypto is being touted as a way to increase financial inclusion, but we haven't seen it actually work. In fact, people are losing money in crashes in the values of coins, but they're also paying huge transaction fees to move coins around. Until that gets solved, there's no way that this industry is going to help poor and minority people who are shut out of banks get the access that they need.
Yeah, I mean, it's just laughable when you say that, right? Like, are the fees also democratized and split among people, or where do those fees go? And we saw in the case of FTX, like, that was a very profitable business model until it wasn't, because the Sam Bankman-Fried allegedly participated in fraud there. So I know you have a hard out right now at 12:40. So thank you so much for coming on. And of course, solidarity with the New York Times Guild and all of the workers who are striking today. Emily Flitter, reporter covering banking and Wall Street for the New York Times, author of The White Wall, How Big Finance Bankrupts Black America. Emily, thanks so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. This was great.
Wonderful. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will talk a little bit more about the gay marriage vote. We are back. We only had Emily for a short time, so we're going to close out the first hour of this program talking about the same-sex marriage vote that was just signed into law. I was vocal about like wanting to push the same-sex marriage bill vote through before the midterm elections, because there were a lot of Republicans in the Senate, Ron Johnson included, who were very hesitant to take that vote. And it might have provided the Democrats with some political benefit. But it luckily, I mean, Schumer must have gotten some assurances. They were able to pass it without the pressure of the midterms. So it's a good thing that it happened.
Yeah, right? You know, it's the sort of thing where they don't have the credibility for me to say, like, trust them on that.
Right.
And it's also the sort of thing where, you know, I was talking to Griscom and, like, in the height of the frustration about the rail thing, it's like, I don't want to hear about this. But then you actually zoom back and be like, this is actually going to be massively consequential for people's rights and making sure that we don't go backwards into the time where, like, oh, you can't get in, like, visitation rights or whatever the fuck.
Right. And so if he had some inside knowledge and some assurance that it would pass after the midterms, like, They burned us many times before. We have no reason to trust it, but it's good and that it worked out this time.
Exactly. And it's like, that's the sort of thing. It's like, it's one on the pile of, okay, your word was good there.
Yeah, right. Okay. And then we have the mountain next to
exactly.
it. But like at the same, so still though, it passed the Senate. It passed the filibuster threshold. They got enough Republicans on board, and then it went to the House. And just this morning, they passed the legislation. It enshrines marriage equality for same-sex couples and interracial couples. So it includes Loving v. Virginia in there as well. And that's huge because, as Matt was just alluding to there, it's under threat. Given what we've seen, what happened with Roe v. Wade, Clarence Thomas wrote a concurring opinion when they overturned Roe, essentially saying, hey, right-wing groups, we will also examine some of the other precedents in here, like Griswold v. Connecticut, mm-hmm. which is for contraception, like gay marriage, Lawrence v. Texas, and that was Lawrence v. Texas was on same-sex relationships, and that was about like sodomy or something. Obergefell, they were also indicating that they might look into, and so
you saw the propaganda arm gearing up about like, well, what is marriage? Is it this or is it that? And we need to have definitions about things. So,
and Thomas literally said in a concurring opinion, "Bring this to us, and we will help you out, right-wing groups." Yeah. And so this makes it a lot harder for that to happen, but. Here is a Republican Bob Good speaking on the House floor before they successfully voted to enshrine same-sex and interracial marriage into law. But this is like very emblematic of how right-wingers, bigoted right-wingers, view gay marriage.
Honestly, the bill should be called the Disrespect for Marriage Act. This bill certainly disrespects God's definition of marriage, a definition that has served his creation well for more than 5,000 years of recorded history. And his definition is the only one that really matters. This bill would codify into federal law the Supreme Court's wrongly decided Obergefell decision and ensure that the marriage laws in the most liberal state, irrespective of how radical they might become in the future, think polygamy, bestiality, child marriage, or whatever, must be legally recognized in all states. It was wrong when the Supreme Court made law in the Obergefell decision requiring that the marriage law in Massachusetts had to become the law of the whole country when Massachusetts approved gay marriage. This was overriding the will of the people and their elected representatives, as no other state to that point had been able to pass through referendum or state legislature a gay marriage law. The fact is, traditional biblical marriage is the foundation of a strong society and a strong culture. I'll say it once again, almost everything that plagues our society is a failure to follow God's design for marriage, morality, and the family.
Like the lady
the perfect, omniscient, immutable God knows what he's doing. But this legislation repeals the correct definition of marriage in federal code and requires the federal government to recognize any marriage if the marriage was valid in the state where it was performed. And...
yeah, God knows what he's doing. Yeah. Luckily, I didn't vote for President God.
My definition of marriage, Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, you fools.
Boom.
I really hope that Representative Bob Good never wore a cotton blend. Because I saw in the Bible, you cannot weave two different cloths.
And
good sir.
Just want to give a little background on Mr. Good. He's one of the four or five Republicans who doesn't want to support Kevin McCarthy for Speaker of the House. So he's a thorn. He's going to be a thorn in the side for Republican leadership for the next few years now that they're in control. And he won his seat by a convention of Virginia delegates because the former member of that seat, Denver Riggleman, officiated a same-sex wedding, which was too much for that county Republican party. So they gave the seat to Bob Good instead.
Ah, well, anyway, that's that freak there. But it, like, they're theocrats. We've talked about it on this program a lot. If what he said there sounds insane and likely unpopular with a majority of people in this country, you'd be right, because nobody wants to be limited by that dude's interpretation of God's will, because as like there's a lot of rules in the Bible that I'm sure Bob Good does not follow. But
that sort of thing is, that's, you know, Dave Rubin when he's talking about, like, I think we should be allowed to have our relationships, but you have to say there may have been a reason why these sort of hierarchies existed. And I don't want to, I want to be the exception that proves the rule. Like, this sort of biblical fundamentalism is taking up the entire right, even the ones who used to be, like, atheists.
Yeah, and the reason is that it's power and oppression and systems of that enshrined that. That's the reason, Dave. It's, like, historical through lines of domination. And so what's also interesting about, like, what he was trying to say there, or kind of funny, is he undercuts his own point, which is that the Supreme Court, they decreed it on the land, and they said that this is what the law will be, that gay marriage has to be respected. And it's, okay, but now Congress is saying it. This was the exact argument that, you know, hair splitters tried to make about Roe v. Wade. Well, I don't like that the Supreme Court made this decision. It should have gone through the halls of Congress because it's not not sound foundationally, and it can be undercut. That's true, but it was the right decision, and Congress wasn't going to do it. So, also, fine, we protect it.
One thing on, sorry to cut you off, but
yeah, it's okay.
One thing on marriage is, like, the idea that the churches didn't start really getting into, we're the ones who do the marriage stuff, until Protestant versus Catholic became a big thing, and then it became a thing of, like, recruiting people and try to enshrine them into your belief system for the rest of the time. Like, there was hundreds of years after Jesus' crucifixion for the Catholics that they left it up to the state.
I mean, right, and so now they act as if it is, like, as natural as
God
air and water.
God said so 6,000 years ago, and the church has been doing it ever since. I'm like, no.
No,
what
no.
What are you talking about?
But, and so, anyway, just basically the point is that this is a really good day. It's going to go to Biden's desk. It will be much more protected than Roe and abortion rights have been because of that dynamic. So now he doesn't get to cry, and Republicans like him don't get to cry about how undemocratic it is that the Supreme Court has imposed this on the people who already overwhelmingly support the right for gay couples to marry, and interracial couples to marry, by the way. You don't get to cry about it anymore. It's been passed through Congress, passed the filibuster, passed the House, going to Biden's desk, and hopefully this makes... I mean, we're seeing an anti-gay court case in front of the Supreme Court right now, and they're going to rule on that in the upcoming summer of next year. And so, you know, like, this might maybe give them the least insane people like John Roberts some pause. We'll see.
Hearing Southern representatives talk about the will of the people regarding things like making, your Massachusetts marriage law that said white people can marry black people. You're like, well, what people, right? Like, you're substituting, like, everybody that is within those borders of that state with the voting coalition and the people who are empowered to vote as
right.
The people. And that is how you sort of enshrine racism and Jim Crow in a sort of more stealth form.
Exactly. All right. Well, with that, we might just kind of head into the fun half on the earlier side. We have a lot of good clips to get to, so that's good for you. If you're a member, only if you're a member, and then you have access to the fun half. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. You can support our good work, help us pay our bills by paying us. That's nice. And also, just if you like the show, keeping it independent, I mean, that's a huge part of that. We rely on your support. So jointhemajorityreport.com. Today on ESVN, Bradley and I will be giving our picks against the spread. We are now nearly tied, with Bradley's pushes being the differential there. I think our scoring system should be one for... someone suggested this in the comments. I think it's right. One for wins, minus one for losses, zero for pushes.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I do think that it looked like a few people had said that in regular betting parlance, pushes kind of cancel out anyways.
So yeah, so sense. There we go. Yeah. All right, well, deal. Great. So we'll be diving into that. But I also do want to talk about Jerry Jones leaking Odell Beckham Jr.'s knee status to the press after deciding that in a contract negotiation tactic, just always classy. That guy is the Giants and Bills also saw his records, chose not to do that. And what that says about how ownership tries to discipline a guy that might be asking for a little bit more money in contract negotiations that they won't like. I also wanted to touch on Brittany Griner on ESPN as well as some World Cup updates. So youtube.com/ESPN show, check us out. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Yeah, Left Reckoning this Sunday for patrons. We're talking with Deep State Cuba of This Is Revolution. We're reviewing Tucker Carlson's End of Men documentary about the ball tanning and sperm cups being halved and stuff like that. So we're going to get into that. Cuba has been in on the we need to reach out to particularly lost men so they don't get caught up in shining red lights at their genitals and expecting it to make them more manly. So that's what we're going to be doing. Patreon.com/leftreckoning. Also, Left is Best live in New York, including Emma Vigeland and Sam Cedar. We'll have a live show, This Is Revolution. Jason Miles will be there. Also, Ben Burgess of Give Them an Argument and me and David from Left Reckoning and other guests will be there as well. January 22nd at The Cutting Room in Manhattan, New York.
Yes, get your tickets, and we should put the link to those tickets in the YouTube and podcast description. So we will do that in case you want to come see us. That'll be a really fun show. Looking forward to that. So we don't have Binder and Brandon yet, just because we had a short guest today. So check out Doomed, check out Scam Economy. Check out all that good stuff.
Check out the Discourse.
The Discourse, yes, sorry. That is Brandon Sutton's show. And, we're going to head into the fun half. We'll be taking your calls, reading your IMs, 646-257-3920. See you there.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Oh, no. Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 back. Boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back.
Snowflakes says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a fucking nightmare!
Bring back DJ Denner.
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. Okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday!
My birthday!
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy!
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. What? Come on. What? Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total.
Pussy, 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 pussy.